So without further ado, to the event that we've all been waiting for, I shan't keep you a second longer. I'd like to call upon our very own Belfast son and Oscar nominee, that great actor of stage and screen, Stephen Ray, to officially welcome our guest and our brother to West Belfast, Michael Moore.
Thank you. Well, I can't tell you, I'm hugely honoured that I've been asked to introduce Michael. Michael Moore is already one of the great figures of the 20th century.
He has shown us that
moral courage is suddenly possible again. Someone was talking to me a few weeks ago about conditions in America being likely that a McCarthy era would return. I said, it's not possible. They said, why not? I said, because Michael Moore won't shut up. Yeah. They can't own him. He's what we call in parts of the North a nadger. He goes at it and goes at it. And what he has done is that he's shown us what an individual can do with nothing but his citizenship and an obsessively inquiring mind. The fact that stupid white men went to the top of the bestseller lists without the cooperation of his publisher, the fact that the Academy voted that Bowling for Columbine should get an Oscar, the fact that an online petition has urged Michael to run for the presidency, I know he thinks that's absurd, and it is, but it shows that there is a huge constituency there which is now becoming emboldened enough, I hope, to vote out George W. Bush in 2004. Yeah. Michael's work is a triumph of decency, compassion and truth, but also a triumph of immense wit and humour, delivered from a position of high intellectual and moral authority. Ladies and gentlemen, you welcome Michael Moore. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Wow. It's my first time in Belfast. I've only been here a couple of hours. So kind of you. Very generous of you. And now I'd like to finish what I started to say at the Oscars before I was so rudely cut off. Thank you, Stephen, for that introduction, and thank you for the people of the festival here, and for Terry George, who suggested that we come here, and for my daughter, Natalie, who's here, my wife, and Kathleen. We're actually here because our daughter graduated from college in June, and we said to her, we'll, for your graduation present, we'll take you anywhere in the world that you'd like to go, and she said, I want to go to Belfast. And Derry. So we're spending the week driving around the north and northwest of Ireland here. So this just happened to come at a good time. And I see Jerry Adams here, and I'd like to thank him for everything that he's done. And thank him for being here, too, Jerry. When we had our show TV Nation on the BBC, one of the stories, one of the pieces that we wanted to do was back when they were not allowed by law for Jerry's voice to be on the BBC. His voice could not be on there, and they had to hire actors to sync in, to dub in someone else's voice. So we proposed this piece where we'd take all this footage of Jerry Adams and but we were going to have like Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Arnold Schwarzenegger, George C. Scott as Patton. And it was actually the first time we tried to contact Charlton Heston, because I just thought the voice of Moses coming out of Jerry's mouth, leading his people to the promised land, I thought would just be too cool on the BBC. Of course, the idea was appropriately nixed by the BBC authorities, so it never aired there. I spent about a month in London back in November. I did a show there at the Roundhouse, and I had this sort of profound experience one day. It was before it was a Saturday, and somebody asked if I'd like to go to a football game, and I'd never been to a real football game, not American football, but you know, yours and the rest of the world's football. And so they took me to the Arsenal Stadium for an Arsenal versus Tottenham game, and I was completely blown away by the. I don't know if you've traveled to America, you've been to an American sporting event, if you've been like to a baseball game or a basketball game. The fans there are pretty quiet. I don't know if you've noticed that. It's pretty sedate. It was years of Big Macs and other things, you know, will do that to you. It just kind of totally numbs your brain and your emotional response to things. But sitting in the Arsenal Stadium, it was like I was in a, there was 70,000 people there all singing songs for 2 hours, nonstop. And I'd never seen anything like this. It was like one long Broadway musical. And they were all like in perfect harmony. It was like I couldn't. And I'm thinking, these are the people that have been running the show for all these years. There's all these, you know, they're just, they're, one team in London. There's only one team in London. And then they all get really quiet. One team in London. All these big, like, you know, British guys. But they're all, and there's only one team in London. What is anybody afraid of these people? How did they run the world for so long? They had a song for everything. It was like the most amazing thing. You know, it was like this guy Freddie would score a goal, and everybody just jumped back up again, and they just start singing. We love, you know, this guy Freddie. You know who I'm talking about? Do you follow this? We love you, Freddie, because you've got red hair. We love you, Freddie, because you're everywhere. I'm going, what the fuck is this? And then the guy that's sitting next to me was explaining to me the rules. Because you see, in our sport, I mean, you guys have scores, you know, like 1-0, you know. American football, even though if you only scored once, you get 7 points for it. You know, it's like we like big scores, you know. And he said, there has to be a defender. You can't just take the ball all the way down the field and kick it in the net. There has to be like somebody in front. And I said, you got to be kidding. And it's like, that is not the American way. We, you know, we have the right to just take that ball wherever we want to take it. It's all just so weird, you know. But we did a press conference here earlier, and the first question came from the BBC asking me about. What I said in my book, Stupid White Men, about my solution to the problem here in Northern Ireland. And it was just a real simple solution. I suggested, if you've read the book, that we just get a couple of priests and just go through some Protestant neighborhoods with some garden hoses and just start spraying water and saying, I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Because once everybody's Catholic, then, you know, the problem's over. And I put forth to those Protestants who would object to this, I said, but look, there's a lot of good reasons to become Catholic. And I put forth, you know, my best case on behalf of our side. We have more sex. That's clear. It should be clear. Or more reckless sex. More unprotected sex, maybe. I don't know. But I would say definitely more sex. That's usually a good come on to get somebody to come over to your side. I suggested that if you're Catholic, we have more days off. We have more holy days than the Anglicans do. So if you just get down with the virgin birth and the Immaculate Conception, there's 2 days off. Who would not, you know, go for that religion? 2 less days of having to work. And actually, there's, at least in America, there's 8 holy days. So that's 8 full days off, paid days off, if everybody here would just go Catholic. Go Catholic! So the BBC woman was, I don't know, she was upset at that, but I was just kidding, really. I respect all religions and the right of everyone to practice their faith without punking on everybody else. But I guess what I want to talk about here today, and then maybe we'll take some questions if you'd like to do that before we leave here, is the sad and sorry state of affairs in the United States of America. I guess I need to tell you. I guess I want to give you the good news first. The good news is that the majority of Americans did not vote for George W. Bush. Never, ever forget this. He lost the election. So know right off the bat that 53% of the American public voted for a Democrat or a Green. And that is where the majority of Americans are at. The American public, contrary to what you might have been told, is actually a very liberal, very progressive group of people. And all we hear all the time is how America's turned to the right, America's more conservative, the Christian coalition is running the country, et cetera, et cetera. But the truth is, if you ask Americans, if you look at any opinion poll on the issues, the American public is very liberal, very progressive. The majority of Americans believe in labor unions. The majority of Americans are pro-choice. The majority of Americans want stronger environmental laws. You go down the whole list of things, Americans are very open, very liberal, very progressive. They just don't have any leadership on that end of the political spectrum. There's rarely anyone to vote for who's going to have the spine to stand up to the Republicans and the conservatives. That's the problem. That's the problem. So I'm here to tell you, as a representative of that majority that is very liberal and very progressive, that the American public doesn't like what they see and they don't like what's going on. George W. Bush has enjoyed these high approval ratings since September 11th because, in my opinion, anytime any group of human beings are attacked, they're going to rally behind the leader, no matter who the leader is. And that's what happened. 3,000 people died all at once. And it horrified the nation, and they looked to see who was in charge. And he was busy running away, first to Louisiana, then to Nebraska that day. He hid underground for a while and then decided that looked bad, so he decided to come back that night. But that's all you know, it's more like, it's not that they love George W. Bush, it's more like love the one you're with. You know, it's just like, this is who we're stuck with, what are we going to do? Before the Iraq War, 54% of the American public said that they were opposed to going into this war without the support of the United Nations and all our allies. 54%, the majority. But once the war started, then the majority said that they were behind it, because who are the people that are sending their sons and daughters over there but the very people that are getting a phone call from a pollster saying, so, do you support this? What do you say about this? And you're not going to say anything against Bush. You're not going to say anything against the war, because it's your child over there, or it's your neighbor's child. And you don't want to say anything that might risk their lives or whatever. That's the psychology behind that. It's not because the American public supports the issues and the policies of George W. Bush. In fact, in the 2 years that he's been president, we've lost 2.5 million jobs. The unemployment rate has soared. The economy is in the toilet. And that, more than anything, should provide fertile ground for the American public to come out next year, assuming all their votes get counted, and remove George W. Bush from office. Years ago, the American public, 80% of the American public, supported the death penalty. 80%. That has dropped now to somewhere around 52%. It's dropped almost 30 percentage points in just 5 years. Because a group of college students at Northwestern University in Chicago decided to do a class project. And in the class project, they found 11 people in just one state on death row who did not commit the crime, who were completely innocent. 11 people that the state was going to execute. As soon as the American public started to hear that, support for the death penalty dropped dramatically. Even though many Americans may still support it in their heart, or support the idea of executing somebody in concept, they will not support the execution of an innocent individual or the chance of that happening. And that's why that poll number has dropped so dramatically. And I think that when people hear the truth, as they're hearing it now about Iraq, that the American public was lied to over and over and over again, lied to about the weapons of mass destruction, lied to about there being a connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. That was the most incredible lie of all. It actually got a majority of Americans believing at one point, a few months ago, that Saddam Hussein had something to do with September 11th. That's how good they are in the Bush White House, that they can put these lies out there and they can deliver them in such a believable way. And that at first people will fall for it, just as they fall for it and have fallen for it in America and in other countries around the world since the beginning of time. But if you present the truth to them, they will come around. And that's what I'm seeing happening now in the United States. The reaction to me after the Oscars in the initial days after the, because I said what I said in the first week of the war, there was quite a violent reaction amongst a good segment of the population toward what I had said. 4.5 months later, I can't walk down the street without every other person shaking my hand or thanking me or saying, you were right, and I was mad at you when you said it, that this was a fictitious war being led by a fictitious president for fictitious reasons. But that now, the truth is out. And the Bush administration has even had to admit that they've not told the truth. There's something about people, once they believe in something so strongly and then find out that they've been deceived in such a blatant manner, they then flip the other way, and they flip with a vengeance. And I'm confident that they will not forget what has happened and what was told to them. And as every day goes by, where more American kids are killed in Iraq, for what? For the oil that will line the pockets of profits for Bush and his friends, for Halliburton, Dick Cheney's company, that now has virtually all the oil contracts in Iraq. As this comes out, each day, the latest thing today in the New York Times, those mobile labs that were helping to produce the biological weapons we were told about, they were there to blow up balloons. It was helium for balloons. When the people find out that the war was fought for weapons of mass balloonery, I'm sorry, folks, it's over at that point. It's over for Bush and his people. It's all about trying to get them all afraid. Afraid. Fear, right? That's the best weapon of all, isn't it? You know? September 11th, Osama bin Laden. Oh, that was just pounded at us. I mean, we've forgotten about him now. One senator calls him Osama bin Forgotten. But in the months after September 11th, it was all about Osama. He's everywhere. Osama bin Laden. He's going to kill all of you. He's the most biggest evildoer of all time. He's a tall man. He's a big monster. Right? We were just pummeled with this day after day after day. And of course, Osama didn't help. He sent those videotapes in, right, every few days, you know. Remember those tapes he was sending with the little Flintstones set behind him? You know, the boulders and the...
Hello, my name is Osama bin Laden.
The little microphone in his hand, right?
I am Osama bin Laden. I'm going to kill all Americans. Thank you and good night.
those tapes. And then they stopped coming. Why did he stop doing these videos? Probably because he had to hold his own microphone. That's my guess, right? Because, you know, he's doing these. If you've ever worked with anybody making a mute, if you ever made a video, you know, they're not. They don't want to hold. They want a boom guy holding the microphone. He's the most important evil doer of all time. Why is he having to hold his own microphone? You know, he probably walked off the set and never came back. You know. But you know, you can't scare the world's only superpower. You know, with 40,000 nuclear weapons, saying that there's one guy, he's the new enemy, he's going to replace the Soviet Union, Osama bin Laden. It just doesn't work. So you've got to get more. So that's when we start hearing more about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, I don't know which it is. You know, as Americans, if we can't spell it, we're afraid of it. So, what was Al-Qaeda? What is Al-Qaeda? It's a men's club, right? Basically, it's Osama's men's club. That's all that is. We must build more bombs because of Al-Qaeda. It's just absolutely insane, you know. And then the Axis of Evil, that was the next big thing. Now that worked better because those are countries, right? Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, right? All the focus went to Iraq right away, and a little bit to Iran. North Korea was ignored at the beginning. Do you remember that? And after a few weeks of being ignored, suddenly North Korea's like, hello, hello, over here, hello. We already have the bomb. What about us? Hello. You can see the Bush administration, you know, saying, who let them into the Axis of Evil? Shut the fuck up. Wait your turn. We'll get to you. I don't know. It's just all so crazy, isn't it? I'm in the final stages of writing my next book, and it's coming out in October. It's called Dude, Where's My Country? And I wrote a chapter yesterday, and I thought, geez, if you'd like to be the first people to hear these words, I'd like to. Do you mind? It's called The United States of Boo. They call it a war on terror. How exactly do you conduct a war on a noun? Wars are fought against countries, religions, peoples. They are not fought against nouns or problems. Anytime that's been attempted, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, it fails. Our leaders would have us believe this is a guerrilla war fought by thousands of foreign terrorists on our soil. But this is not what is taking place, and it's time to do a reality check. About once every 2 years, Americans are targets of an act of terror. First the African embassies, then the USS Cole, then September 11th. That's it, since 1998, so we're about due for another one. What this translates into is that in the year 2000, your chances of as an American of being killed in a terrorist attack in the United States was exactly zero. In 2002, your chances of dying in a terrorist incident in the U.S. was zero. So far in 2003, zero. Even in the tragic year of 2001, your chance as an American of dying in an act of terrorism was 1 in 150,000. In 2001, you had a far greater chance of dying from the flu or pneumonia, 1 in 4,000, from taking your own life, 1 in 10,000, being a homicide victim, 1 in 35,000, or riding in a car, 1 in 5,000. But no one freaked out over the possibility of being killed every time you drove in your dangerous car to buy a heart disease-inducing donut from a coughing teenager. The suicide rate alone means that you were a greater danger to yourself than any terrorist. All these causes of death were far greater than terrorism, but there were no laws passed. No countries were bombed, no emergency expenditures of billions of dollars, no National Guard units dispatched, no orange alerts, no nonstop tickers scrolling details across the bottom of CNN to send you into a panic. There was no response from the public but indifference or denial, and at best, acceptance that these tragedies are just part of life. But when multiple deaths happen at the same time with such viciousness and on live TV as they did on that day, no rationalization with statistics can undo the damage done to the American psyche. We've come to believe that we are in harm's way, that any of us anywhere in this vast country could die at any time. Never mind the chances of that happening are virtually nil. A mass psychosis has gripped the country. I'm part of it. You're a part of it. You, the Americans. And even high-ranking generals who now weep openly are part of it. Irrational fear is a killer. It throws off our survival compass. It makes us reach for a gun when we hear a noise in the middle of the night and you end up shooting your wife who was just on her way to the bathroom. It makes us not want to live near someone of another race. And it allows us to willingly give up the civil liberties we've enjoyed for over 200 years simply because our leader says there is a terrorist threat. These are some of the terror alerts that have been issued recently in the United States. And these, I'm quoting, these are real. Watch out for model airplanes packed with explosives. Hobby shops should be checked. People buying model airplanes, the little tiny airplanes, it could fly it with a little bunch of bag of C4 into a building and blow it up. People may be lurking near train tracks preparing to derail trains. Look for suspicious people lingering too long near gas stations. Al-Qaeda may be setting the forest fires out west. And it goes on and on and on. Boy, those terrorists sure are busy. Explosive model airplanes, forest fires, lions, tigers, bears. The boogeyman is coming to get me. Run for your lives. The only thing that is more amazing than this phony game of poof is our ability to fall for it. What happened to our basic common sense? You know, that reflex in your brain that used to make you scream bullshit when you were confronted with such obvious nonsense? That's what happens when your fear radar is out of whack. You become so discombobulated, you can't distinguish any longer between the real and the unreal. Why has our government gone to such absurd lengths to convince us that our lives are in danger? The answer is nothing short of their feverish desire to rule the world. First by controlling us, and in turn getting us to support their efforts to dominate the rest of this planet. Sounds crazy, huh? It reads more like a movie script, doesn't it? But Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Wall Street, Fortune 500, they see this post 9/11 America in fear as their moment. A moment handed to them by fate, via the terrorists, to seize the reins and ram the USA down the throats of any people in the world who dare question who is number one. Who is number one? I said, who is number one? That's right, say it loud. Say it for George and Dick and John and Condi. We are number one. USA, USA, USA. Yeah. Listen, they know, Bush and these guys, that real Americans are not into dominating anyone. So they have to sell this to us. And they have to sell it inside a package of fear. In order to properly scare us, they need a big bad enemy. With 9/11, Bush and his right-wing hawk buddies have found the enemy that could sell to the public. A war without end. A permanent war. If you get the people to believe in this, they'd let you do anything, just as long as it's in the name of protecting them. This is Bush's version of the old mafia protection racket. There's somebody out there who's going to mess you up. Osama, he did it. Saddam, he did it. Those crazy Ayatollahs, they might do it. North Korea, they will do it. Hello, PLO. We'll protect you. Just give us all your money and all your rights. And keep your trap shut. For the next year, you all are going to hear from Bush about how there's a war going on, a war on terror, a war to liberate and rebuild Iraq, a war against Iranian clerics, a war against North Korean nuclear madmen, a war against Colombian drug lords, a war against extremism, a war against communism in Cuba, a war against Hamas,
a war against, and to maintain this endless war, they need endless fear, a fear that can only be extended indefinitely by taking away our basic civil rights. The right wing, they need to keep this war going for as long as possible, because it keeps the people distracted. Everyone, except those who die in a war, loves a good war, especially one you can win quickly. We, good. Them, bad. Them, dead. We win. Cue the cameras. The victorious President of the United States is landing on another aircraft carrier. This is how Bush intends to run his entire re-election campaign. I won you a war. Then I won you another war. But there are more wars, and you need me to win them too. It'll be that old slogan that you shouldn't change a horse in the middle of a stream. I've always thought it was interesting that the mass murder of 9/11 was allegedly committed by a multi-millionaire. Now, we always say that that event that day was committed by a, quote, terrorist, or a, quote, Islamic fundamentalist, or an Arab. But we never define Osama by his rightful title, multimillionaire. We have never read a headline saying 3,000 killed by multimillionaire. It would be a correct headline, wouldn't it? So why haven't we seen it? Osama has assets totaling at least $30 million. He's a multimillionaire. So why isn't that the way we see this person? As a rich fuck who kills people. Why didn't that become the reason for profiling potential terrorists? Instead of rounding up suspicious Arabs, why don't we say, oh my God, a multimillionaire killed 3,000 people. Round up the multimillionaires. Throw them all in jail. No trials. Deport the millionaires. Deport them. We need protection from our own multimillionaire corporate terrorists. The ones who rip off our old age pensions, destroy the environment, deplete irreplaceable fossil fuels in the name of profit, deny us our right to universal health care, take people's jobs away whenever the mood hits them. What do you call a doubling of the homeless and the hungry in the last 3 years? Are not these acts of terrorism? Do they not cost lives? Is it not all part of a calculated plan to inflict pain on the poor, just so that a few rich men can get even richer? We have our own terrorists to deal with, and we need our entire focus returned to them so that we can one day live in a country where the people once again pick the president, a country where the wealthy learn they have to pay for their actions, a free country, a safe country, a peaceful country that genuinely shares its riches with the less fortunate around the world, a country that believes in everyone getting a fair shake, and where fear is seen as the only thing that we truly need to fear. In this book, I have a number of other chapters. One's called Seven Questions for George of Arabia. And I ask a number of innocent questions of George Bush in the book. The first one being, is it true that the Bin Laden family has funded you and your family for the last 25 years? And I put forth the evidence of how Bin Laden money has potentially gone to Bush, starting with his first oil company, Arbusto, back in 1979, all the way up through Bin Laden money funding the Carlyle Group, which his dad is now a major consultant to and involved with. In fact, the Carlyle Group is the 11th largest defense contractor in the United States now. I also ask him about the special relationship between himself and the royal family of Saudi Arabia. And why is it, in the days after September 11th, Bush allowed a private Saudi jet to fly around the United States and pick up 24 members of the Bin Laden family who were living there and take them out of the country without a proper police investigation? Are you aware of this? It was reported in the New York Times, it was reported in the New Yorker, it was reported in the London Times, and nobody picked up on it. And when I ran across it, I just thought, what is going on here? Why isn't anybody asked? That's such an odd thing. In the days after September 11th, what is Bush doing worrying about the bin Ladens? Well, he says it's because he's concerned. He was concerned about their safety, and so he wanted to help them out. What's he saying about us as Americans? That we're just going to go out and kill bin Ladens? The FBI was upset because the FBI, you see what the police like to do when there's a murder or 3,000 murders? They like to go and maybe talk to some of the family members. Not to arrest them or anything, but just, what do you know? Who do you know? Can you help us? There might be somebody there that might have an idea or might be willing to help when they go back to Saudi Arabia. No, none of that was allowed. None of that was allowed. No, just, here you go, free trip to Paris. That's where they ended up. Imagine after Oklahoma City, when the federal building was blown up, if it was discovered that Bill Clinton had been receiving money from the McVeigh family, the family of the guy who blew up the Oklahoma City building for the last 25 years, what do you think the press and the Republicans would have done with that? Or that Clinton was so concerned about the safety of the McVeigh family up in Buffalo that he allowed for a private jet to take them to Paris. Can you imagine what the opposition would have done with that, what the media would have done with that? You see, that's the problem with liberals in the United States, the liberal leadership. It's an oxymoron. They allow the Republicans to get away with this stuff. They don't stand up to them. They don't have a backbone. This is why there's this great disconnect between that majority that I described earlier that's very progressive on the issues but has no leadership. The other side, the right wing, you've got to admire them. I mean, you've got to admire their conviction. They believe in something. I mean, they're up at the crack of dawn trying to figure out what group of people they're going to screw today. I mean, that is just, you know, the only time we see the crack of dawn is when we've been up all night. You know, it's like our side is, you know, they're up at 6 o'clock. They've got a good 3-4 hour head start on us, passing bills and everything in Congress, and we're just like looking for a latte. You know, it's our side is, and I say this to Americans. I say, you know, that conservative in your family, there are those things that you admire about the conservative, like they never lose their car keys. You know, they always know where their keys are. We're always like, have you seen my keys? No, I haven't seen your keys. Well, I don't know why. You know, I give them to you. Know, it's like they're like, you know, they've got little hooks inside the back door with little labels on each key. You know. Here's my SUV key, my Mercedes key, my Beamer key, you know. That's, you know, it's like we need to get our act together. I say this over and over to people in the United States. But, of course, they come back with, well, you know, so who's the leader? Who's going to lead us? Who do we got? Who do we got that's going to remove Bush next year? That's a good question. You look at the 9 that are running, it doesn't look very good. Not right now. But I tell them to have faith in Bush's ability and the greed that exists in his party, that the economy will get that bad and they won't be able to turn it around and people will vote. They'll vote from that issue alone. And they're probably ready at that point to put anybody in there. At least that's my hope. I don't know. I mean, I have other ideas of people I think should run. Maybe we can talk about that during the question and answer or whatever. You know, I am at this point not filled with despair. I do not believe that Bush will be returned for his first elected term. And I know I'm in the minority with that opinion right now. But a lot can happen in a year's time. Just a couple things I wanted to say about the situation here. And I'm a little nervous saying anything, actually, because, you know, I think people who live here have had to suffer through enough Americans pontificating about this issue. And we're a fairly ignorant people to begin with. So National Geographic did a survey last fall, and they found that of 18 to 25-year-olds in America, 85% could not find either Iraq or Israel on the map. 85%. See, I don't know, call me crazy, but I think that the first rule is if you're going to bomb a country, you got to at least know where it is.
So if 85% of the young adults don't know where it is, then you should be forbidden from bombing that country. Just because you could be bombing, you know, anybody at that point. 11% in this survey, 11% of these young Americans could not find the United States on the globe. Seriously, 11%. I don't want you to think poorly of us, and I'm not trying to paint a bleak picture here. I know you've probably thought this, you know, and you probably think it quietly, and you're very polite, and no one has said to me today all the things that are wrong with America, and you know, but I know that it just must scare the shit out of you to think that 11% of the people couldn't find the United States on a globe. But that's where I live. So I think that, you know, so many Americans have had a lot to say about Ireland, about Northern Ireland, and I certainly don't want to pretend to be any sort of expert on this. And I've always come at it from what to me just seems to be a basic common sense and basic human decency, that no group of people should be discriminated against for any reason whatsoever. That's just the bottom line of humanity. I was thinking as we were coming up the end one there, as we crossed over the border, which I couldn't quite tell exactly where the border was, which I guess was a good thing, right? Except everything suddenly was just in English. I guess that was the clue. But it sort of felt good to be back in one of our fellow members of the Coalition of the Willing. you know, The peace process here should not be allowed to be ignored, bogged down, stalled, reversed, simply because we've got an idiot in the White House who clearly will pay zero attention to this problem as long as he's sitting in the White House. Zero. I think, you know, I was very critical of Bill Clinton while he was president, but certainly one of the things I think he attempted to try to do was to try and put this on the map and try to help in some way to resolve the problem and to convince the British government that that there really was no other way. Because throughout history, that's usually what happens. Sooner or later, the unjust position has to fall. That is the lesson of history, and that's the good news, and that's what should keep us filled with a sense of optimism here. We had slavery, and then we didn't have slavery. The people of South Africa were being controlled by a white minority, and what were they told? If we allow Mandela and the blacks to take over, what's going to happen to the whites, right? And you hear this, what will happen to the other side here if we have true representation, equal rights, and voting power in Northern Ireland? But you see, that's what's so great about history, too, is that the formerly oppressed very rarely, hardly ever, turn around and do damage to those who have oppressed them. The whites in South Africa were not beheaded. The blacks in the South did not rise up after the Civil War to go and kill every whitey they could find. You could say they would have justification even. You could at least understand how they would feel. But they didn't do that. Women in America were not allowed to vote until 81 years ago. That's it. You couldn't vote. So for the majority of our history in the United States, more than half the population was prohibited from voting, which is called an apartheid situation. And once given the vote, what did women do? They just voted for men. They didn't throw all the men out. Wasn't a big scary thing. The unjust position, when it fails, when it's removed, and replaced by the just,
It always ends up being a good thing. Even for those who are formerly unjust, they don't suffer as a result of it. Why is that? Because those who have been oppressed by the injustice know what it feels like. And because all of us as human beings are good at our core, because we really don't want harm to come to another human being, the brave thing that will happen, that always happens, is that a hand is extended. That's what will happen here. That's what will happen here. What is the fear that is being continually pumped into the people here? You know what this press conference I did while we had the press in here before you came in here? It was really a strange thing. A number of questions were asked where the litmus test questions. Before I could say anything about anything else, I had to say that the IRA was wrong. They should decommission their weapons first. And in this whole kind of sorry-ass, boring litany of bullshit. It's bullshit. It's old news. It's the past. And, you know, I just wanted to say to them, get over it. Get over it. Most people want to live in peace. Most people are sick of the situation. What are we asking for here? An election? An election? Oh! Oh! Not an election! Oh! What could happen? What are you afraid of? Don't be afraid. We're Catholic. We like to have sex. We like to have days off. Assumption, Immaculate Conception, Ascension, right? We're okay, don't worry. Now, you must repeat, Mike, before you speak here today, denounce the IRA, decommission the weapons first, IRA first, please. I said, well, you know, on the show that we had on Channel 4, I said we had a big decommissioning night. And I had Malachi McCourt as an author. You probably know him. He's Frank's brother. And I had him over here in Belfast. And we were live throughout Britain that night. And I made an offer to anybody who would bring any weapon in. And I had a guy there with a blowtorch and a thing. We were going to melt the gun right there live. Anybody who would bring the gun in, 2 free tickets to a U2 concert. And so we weren't getting any takers, so I started calling RUC offices around Belfast to see if they'd like to decommission their weapons first. And all acts of terror are evil. All acts of violence are wrong. Individual acts of violence or violence committed by groups who have been living in an oppressed situation, compared to violence organized and perpetrated by the state, a democratic state, a free state. When you allow a free and open democracy like the United Kingdom participate and coordinate and plan acts of violence and assassination, that is the ultimate evil. That's the ultimate evil. And it's, let's get out of this. Now you go first, now you go first, now you go first, now you go first. Shut the fuck up! The people have had it! You, the state, representing the people, put down your guns. Leave this island. Let the people have free, peaceful, open elections. Let them decide their own fate. And you know, we're taught something in civics class, in government class in the United States, about our system of government and about majority rule. But with that lesson in majority rule comes an equal lesson called minority rights. Because the founding fathers, with all of their flaws and all the mistakes they made, They knew that majority rule wasn't enough, that the majority would be without integrity, that the majority would be morally bankrupt if the minority didn't have full and absolute and protected rights. You can't have majority rule without minority rights. That is a basic tenet of democracy. And the sooner we get to that, and the sooner that it's allowed here, and the sooner we keep having these phony baloney show trials like the Columbia Three, you know, I mean, it just... I'm sorry Clinton still isn't around. I heard he's buying a house somewhere here. He's going to go golfing a lot here. Maybe he'll come up with an idea. You're not going to get it from Bush. It's going to have to happen here. The pressure is going to have to keep on Tony Blair. Poor Tony Blair. And you know what?
A short clip now occurs while the tape is changed. Mr. Moore continues. Think about this, right? Think about this. There were the largest anti-war demonstrations ever seen in Britain.
And now they're on him like flies on shit. And this is a good thing. The allies that exist within the British population, for there to be a right and just solution here in Northern Ireland, there couldn't be a better time for that. And we need to recognize that. We need to hold out our hand to those people and say, we're all sick of this. We know that you recognize this. If you recognize the injustice of this happening to the people thousands of miles away in Iraq, for God's sake, please listen to us for a few moments about the injustice that's happening here. Be consistent with your integrity, with your moral position that you've taken, the British people. This is a good time to open it up for questions.